This is Keeping the Faith, a weekly discussion about issues of faith, spirituality, religion, and ethics. Now here's your host, Steve Shoemaker.
On Keeping the Faith this week, we're talking with a panel of four people about the Big Read Project book, The Death of Ivan Illich by Tolstoy. And before I introduce our guests, let me take just a moment to remind people that this is nearing the end of National Poetry Month. And on this program, each week this month, we've started off by reading a poem. And I want to thank the Poetry Foundation for encouraging this, and Poetry Magazine in Chicago, that was the whose poems we read the first time we began this series. Let me read a poem about Roger Ebert. This is one that I wrote a few years back because of my appreciation of Ebert Fest and of Roger's contribution over the years as a movie critic. I had known Roger in his youth when we were in high school together, and it's been fun watching his career and seeing all he's done for the Department of Media, formerly the Department of Communications here at the university, by bringing the film festival here. So here's a very short poem, and it's an acrostic poem, so you'll have to imagine that it spells out down the left side, Roger Ebert. And I've titled this Movie Lover. Responding quickly to a word or face or plot or place, seeing gladly signs of wit, insights, and even truth, in the dark, writing relentlessly for all who read, ever hoping goodness will win before greed drags it down, helping everyone see beauty in one rosebud film frame, celebrating the movies, overlooking none. Movie Lover, a poem I wrote in honor of Roger Ebert and his contribution to movies for people all around the world. And this might not be too bad a place to start talking about Tolstoy's The Death of Ivan Illich, because with the end of Ebert Fest this week, there were several films that dealt with life and death issues and people who were facing death, violence, suffering, pain, isolation, loneliness, some of the themes that we find in this book. Well, we have a distinguished panel here in the studio today talking about The Death of Ivan Illich. This is the last event of the Big Read Project, sponsored here at the University of Illinois in Champaign-Urbana. There have been many events, and we're pleased to be part of it. Our guests today are Rabbi Norman Klein from Sinai Temple. Welcome, Norman.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
Good to have you here. And we also have Sensei Elihu Genmyo Smith from the Prairie Zen Center. Welcome.
Thank you.
Nice to have you here, Elihu. We have two folks from the Community United Church of Christ, Reverend Mike Mulberry.
Hi, Steve. Thanks.
And Reverend Tracy Heilman.
Hello.
Good to have all of you here. So we're crowded in this studio. Actually, it's a fairly generous size, but we are happy to be talking about this book. Now, had any of you read this book before?
Yes.
Not before the last few months, but
In anticipation of this Big Read project.
Yes.
Did others of you read this, like, college? Or?
In my case, yes. I read it in graduate school in a course on death and dying in literature.
Uh-huh.
It was fascinating. Fascinating then to see it in the context of other literature written on the same theme.
I'm sure.
Yeah, I read it in college as well. I think it was more along the lines of, as I became more attracted to the writings of Gandhi and King, that Tolstoy became a person to read. So
they were both influenced by his writings and his thought.
Yes. Yes.
Tracy, had you encountered this before, or was this the first time for you?
This was the first time for me, and I'm kind of embarrassed because I was an English major in college, but somehow missed this one.
You'd read War and Peace several times, but missed this short.
Of course.
Well, Tolstoy's Russian, so English.
That's true.
That's right. Well, let's talk about why do you think the Big Read Project chose the National Endowment for the Arts? Why do you think they chose this particular short novel by, of all things, a Russian 19th century writer for people to be reading in 21st century America? Why is it relevant?
Well, I just one point on that. The person who wrote the introduction, Ronald Blythe, mentions in passing that it's a book that hasn't lost its relationship to its audience throughout the years. There's not that much in it that is dated, and I think people can have access to it directly without too much having to understand the time that it was written and the setting.
I'm seeing other heads nodding in agreement around the table. What are some of those themes that are still pertinent to our time?
Death.
Of course.
And not just death, but the fact that death is so integrally connected with fears, suffering, and all the behavior that we see of others in this book and in our life, how the willingness or unwillingness to face death or the way we construe or misconstrue death, what that does.
I think the thing that struck me so much in the book was how even when he was alive and when all of the characters are alive, they're almost like the living dead, that they have so little life to them that they seem to be avoiding life, filling their lives with things and inconsequential activities so that they don't ever have to engage in life. And I thought that struck very close to home for so much of American culture today.
There were certainly many distractions, many things that were just amusements that were very trivial, and people, while they were engaged in them, realized they were trivial.
Yeah. Right.
I think also the form of the book lends itself to speaking to every generation because I experienced the book as almost liturgical in nature. You know, it was relentless in the way that it continued to. It's kind of like if you don't know the meaning of the book, you're not listening because Tolstoy seems to continue to kind of pound away at the particular ways that this person is, as Tracy said, avoiding life and going forward and creating a culture of nothingness around him going forward. And you get that time after time. It's almost like Psalm 119 is if you don't know the meaning of the psalm by the end that repeats over and over again, then you really are not reading the text. And I felt that way with reading the book is it just had this kind of repetitive character to it that could be mundane and boring, but also almost like a mantra of nothingness.
Now, I realize that some of our listeners will have read this book in their past. Sometimes many of our listeners will have read it very recently as part of this Big Read project here this last month. Others may not have read it at all. Let's be a little bit helpful to listeners who've not read this book. And for me, I think what surprised me the most, and I'm like Tracy, I had not read this before until this last month, preparation for this project. And what surprised me the most was the humor, was the insight that was wry, the insight that was slanted, the relationships between people early on, like that first scene where people have just heard about Ivan Illich's death, yeah. And they're already thinking, okay, who's going to move up? Who's going to take that position? Where will I be in this thing? You know, it was just so human, but also so humorous, and that kind of insight into what we're like, that, as the rabbi was saying earlier, is timeless.
Mm-hmm. You know, one of the questions that's raised right in the beginning that may help people understand a little bit about maybe the context of the plot, too, is that Tolstoy seems to, hammer home that no matter how people encounter death in that society and perhaps also in ours, they always project it onto someone else. That even though we're all going to die, and it's just a fact of life, at least, if not, much more than just, everyone who hears about Ivan Illich's death thinks something along the lines of, at least it wasn't me.
Sure.
Thank goodness it wasn't me. Or it was somebody else, I made it once again. Oh. And in the course of those thoughts, they postpone thinking about death, their own death. And because of that, they never can assess what Ivan Illich is only able to assess at the very end of his life, whether his life was lived in truth and whether he lived a good life or not. And it's only at that point, at the end, that he can come to an acceptance of death, when he can accept the fact that his life was lived, in a sense, without truth.
Elihu, I see you're ready to jump in, but let me just outline very quickly the overall plot for listeners who've not read the book. This is a 45-year-old married man, father of children, a successful person in the Russian legal system, ends up being a magistrate, a judge, at a relatively young age. He's navigated the bureaucracy very well. He's considered a success. But suddenly he has an accident. He's climbing a ladder, doing something mundane, falls as a result of that injury, goes into terrible pain and suffering. The doctors aren't able to help him. He dies. And it's a short novella, a very short 100-page story, filled with much else, but that at least is a rough plot line. Now, you were going to respond perhaps to something Norman was saying.
Well, it seems that I would turn a little of what he said in another direction. It's because people don't face life, and because he did face death, that they don't face life. You see it both in what's significant to him until he really is struggling with the death, and you see in what's significant to all the other people. They don't really know what death is, and they don't face death. They don't face death in any way. And because they don't face death, they can't face life. It's not that life, that they trivialize life. It's that they really can't live their life because they haven't lived their death and they haven't faced the death. The fear of death is what keeps them from living their life, because it keeps them trivializing it. Even after he dies, I'm going to get this. Am I going to get his job? Or what are we going to do? What am I going to have to do, say to the widow, et cetera, all of those things.
And the widow thinking of what her life is going to be, the daughter who's hoping to be married soon, how this death is going to affect mm-hmm. her life. Yeah, all these complications.
And there's no freedom in that. I think that's one of the things that I think Tolstoy is trying to present, is that everybody has their script. Is the guy who has to get away. You were talking about the humor at the start. The guy who's trying to get away for the card game, when he realizes that he's got to put on some show at the funeral of Ivan Illich. But I think one of the moments is that it says it's not only about not facing death, it's also about not facing what your life is all about as you meet conflict. Remember, the one time when there seems to be an opening in Illich's life is when he gets passed over for a job that he thought was rightfully his. And there seems to be an opening there, and he doesn't take it because his life is scripted, and there is no freedom to move away from that script, and he wants it to get back on script so that he can go forward. And, of course, then he is condemned by those same scripts that everybody else is playing out. Most notably, we see it with the doctors, who don't really diagnose him so much as they want to share their script with him and their innate wisdom.
And interestingly, it's a peasant boy servant who reaches out in a compassionate way to him at a time when he's embarrassed about his bodily functions not working and needing help with all these things that happen with illness. And this young man is willing to be gracious to him at this point.
Right.
And Tolstoy apparently in other places emphasizes that.
Well, you know, I'm very attracted to Gerasim. Is that how you pronounce the name? I wonder. And he's sort of a natural person. He doesn't seem to be a thinker. And yet the kinds of things he says are always true. My question, so to speak, for the other people on the panel and I guess myself is Tolstoy trying to say that only when we accept death in a natural way, as if we were animals, I guess, in a sense, you know, so totally unthinkingly in a way, but just accepting of it, then we can get on with our life, as Elihu was saying? I'm not saying that Elihu's saying this. I'm just saying that is it the fact that we've lost the ability to accept death in a natural way and have to learn how to accept it in a, you might say, a highly spiritually developed way in order to be able to go on with our life, is that the problem?
It's interesting to me that the folks who were planning this event here in Champaign-Urbana felt it important to have a group of representatives from various religious traditions as part of this whole discussion, because the Tolstoy book does refer to the divine, does refer to spiritual and ethical issues, and yet it's not in a trivial, facile way. We'll get into that, but let me encourage listeners. We have here in the studio representatives of Judaism, Zen Buddhism, Protestant Christianity, but we couldn't squeeze in representatives of all religious tradition and philosophical tradition into the studio, but you can join us via the telephone. So let me encourage listeners, if you have a comment to make, if you've read the book, if you've thought about this a bit, do give us a call. Anywhere the program is heard, if it's a long-distance call, use this number, 1-800-222-9455. That's 1-800-222-WILL. If you're in Champaign-Urbana, you can access several local lines by punching in 333-9455. So we are eager to have listeners join the conversation, make a comment, or ask a question of our panelists. Elihu, yes.
I wanted to respond to what Norman brought up. In Zen, we have an expression, die once and then live freely. Die once, we say die once on the cushion, meaning in practice. Die completely. In the sense, when you say natural death, in the sense, if we really can embrace death and see that death and life aren't two different things, but life is an expression of the same thing that death is an expression of. If my terms, I would say life is the unborn, the undying. Death is the unborn, undying, if I use fancy language. Then life, death, they're just two coins. We have one coin, we have another coin. It's not a big deal. Then we can live freely. That's in a way what Tolstoy I see getting at. And as an aside, my understanding is that Tolstoy was very well studied in Buddhism and in Taoism, and in fact, probably at his time was attempting to integrate that in the form of Orthodox Christianity that he was teaching and preaching. And if I go one step further, since today is the Russian Orthodox Easter. One of my teachers had a very good friend who was a Russian Orthodox priest, and he said that to really understand that phrase in the Christian Bible where Jesus says to the two thieves on the cross with him, he says, today you will be in paradise with me. Most people think of it, as a future, but really what Jesus is saying is now, hanging on this cross, if we die right here, dying, we are in paradise. Living, hanging, we're in paradise. See? If we can see what our life death is, then no matter what the circumstance is, right here is the paradise.
I think that expresses the Buddhist, the Zen Buddhist, one of the insights very well. Let me contrast that, though, with what I think is a very different perspective from Christianity, which is that death is an evil, that death is an enemy of God, that death should be our enemy, that we should work to maintain life, to enrich life, to keep as many people alive as we possibly can, that life is a good, and perhaps even, if not an ultimate good, very very high on the scale. I think that shows a contrast. Now, I agree that Tolstoy at this point in his life might have been rejecting that, and some of that might be seen here. But I can still see some of the very orthodox, not only Eastern Christianity, but Western Christianity view in this, that the death is not a good thing. But we have a caller who wants to join the conversation. Our technical director, Matt Kessler, has brought a caller to us. Yes, you're on the air, line number 4. Go ahead, please. Yes, the toll-free line. Go ahead.
Yes, hello. Do you hear me?
Yes.
Yes. You were speaking earlier about the pronunciation of the peasant young man's name.
Yes.
And I just wanted to offer my knowledge of Russian as a help, and his
great
name is pronounced Gerasim.
And I know that I've been using the English pronunciation of both Tolstoy and Ivan Illich. Would you like to give us the correct Russian pronunciation while we have you on the phone?
Sure. Tolstoy. That accent falls on the second syllable, Tolstoy, and Ivan Illich. So you're right on with those. The Gerasim, often we want to put the accent on the Gerasim. You know, in English, that's how we would do it. But I think it falls on the third syllable, Gerasim.
Well, thank you for your call.
You're welcome.
Appreciate it. I know I will keep slipping back into the English more. That I was raised on. So, but we'll do the
thank
best we
can.
Thank
you for that grace, Steve.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the issue of some of the things that happened in the story. Let's talk about what seems to be ultimately dissatisfying about Ivan Illich's life as he looks back on it, as he's facing death. What are some of the things that are causing him pain about his life?
Well, he can only remember, and only very vaguely in a sense, certain remote things in his childhood toward the end of his life that he found satisfying and, I guess, happy moments. So the more he thinks about how meaningful and satisfying and true his life was, the more remotely in the past he has to search in order to find something good. And I was trying to figure out a bit about what those good things were, and it seems to be the love of his mother. That seems to be one of the things. For instance, toward the end, at one point, he had done something wrong. I think he had scratched or done something to one of the Moroccan leather pieces of furniture, and he was punished, and then she gave him something to eat. And he felt that she showed comfort and care and love for him.
Forgiveness.
Wow. And that was meaningful to him. But generally speaking, when he's having, when he's making an attempt as he gets sicker and sicker to understand if he had done something wrong or had not lived a life worth living, he keeps coming up against the wall of saying to himself, well, I did everything I was supposed to. Mm-hmm. How could I have not lived a good life? I did everything that was asked of me, that was required of me, that was the right way to behave according to our society. So what is it that
he did it well.
And he did it well. He was successful.
Sure.
And it's only, it seems, after he can get over the conclusion that he did live a good life and actually admit to himself that he didn't. It wasn't sincere. It wasn't right. He didn't make his own choices. That he can, as the image goes in the story, fall through this hole and see the light at the bottom of the bag or whatever the image is. That he goes through this darkness and sees the light at the end. And that's a result of admitting that he made a whole series of life choices that were basically insincere and wrong and not personally satisfying.
Let's talk about a couple of those. What about his choosing finally to get married after a life of apparent early debauchery and taking advantage of women and so on? As I recall it, the woman he marries her because it seems to be sort of time to do that, and she loves him.
Yeah, he talks about that there were two reasons that all of his kind of friends and colleagues thought it was an appropriate match, and she seemed to like him. So since both of those things lined up, this would be an appropriate marriage. And it's not until the marriage becomes real that he that's when he discovers how distasteful it is to him. Having children and having to actually be in relationship with this person, you know, and by the end of the book, he recoils from her. He finds her so distasteful. You know, he's so angry, so filled with hate towards her.
And how is she in relation to him? Her life seems to be pretty separate.
Absolutely. And she even talks about how angry she gets when she realizes that even though she can't stand being around him, even if he died, that wouldn't really solve her problems either.
But at the end of the book, see, he makes a shift at the very end. And the shift is, what you're talking about is before he makes the shift. Mm-hmm. And he makes the shift when he, as he puts it, forgives them. He asks them to forgive him. And he forgives them. And it's at that point that death ceases to be something he fears. The fear of death goes. And when the fear of death goes, then he's able to, even though he continues to be in pain, then it's all gone. It's fine for him. Even though he thrashes around for several hours later, it says in the book, he continues to thrash in pain, but the pain, he's in a sense above it because he's, in a sense, embraced death or whatever else arises.
But I thought it was interesting in that point when he talks about he's getting ready to say to them, forgive, the word comes out wrong and it comes out forget.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And, you know, as Freud implied, there's nothing arbitrary about you skip missing a word and putting some other word in its place. So, and certainly in literature, that's the case. So
exactly.
Clearly Tolstoy was trying to share something with us about the differences between forgive and forget.
But notice he adds on, he says, he was too feeble to correct himself, and he dismissed it knowing that, and he, with capitals H, who needed to understand would understand.
Mm-hmm. Another reference to the divine.
Yes.
Seemingly, yeah.
So he is sort of, how to put it, eliminating the difference in a way, but psychologically, I guess I'm addressing that part of it. If you think, as I do, that the mind works in peculiar ways and something is revealed by any misstatement, there was something in Ivan Illich's personality that wanted to say forget rather than forgive. Mm-hmm. Even if his every intention was to forgive and that God would see his true intention. So,
Now, I read two different English translations of this because I, you know, translations are always a problem. And in one of them, by Ann Pasternak Slater, in this passage, it says, he wanted to add, forgive me, but said, let me pass.
Wow.
So it isn't forget, then
well,
it's a different word.
Well, I don't know. I think it's one of those words that is difficult to translate, and it may have more than one meaning. But I agree with you. The psychology that Tolstoy's insight into human psychology is fantastic. Mm-hmm. And when Ivan Illich is finally able to kind of imagine what somebody else is going through instead of just totally focusing on himself, then this process you've described so well of insights and, if not rapprochement, at least human contact, at least communication, at least...
Well, and death is the teacher. I mean, that's a part of Judeo-Christian mythology that's very strong is, there's a certain sense that before Christianity comes along, death is the final arbiter of justice, you know, and that the rich and poor die alike. And so that is always within, particularly as I read within Jewish mythology, the kind of caution to the rich is be aware that death is the final arbiter of justice, and you will not die any different from a poor person as you die. So to be aware of that as you go forward. And I do think that Tolstoy puts that out, starting with the death, with the funeral. So we know this will be our teacher throughout this particular take on Tolstoy. He is saying death is going to be our teacher throughout this particular narrative.
And how is death our teacher?
Well, I think he's partially saying out of this is when you think you are the master of your destiny going forward, and you are running the script, so to speak, be aware that there is something more transcendent than you at work. And that's why I said there was that chance when he did not get that job of recognizing a transcendent hand at work. And he chose in that way not to see that happen, but to once again exert his own will to make it happen going forward. And what he did, in effect, was he created that culture of death around him so that it surrounded him at his death.
Wait, I don't understand. I mean, I hear things that you're saying, but I see them. I mean, those might work from a Christian point of view, but I don't see them in the text, nor do I see them in reality. I see them as something that you're superimposing when you say the transcendent hand and when you say a culture of death. I don't quite see that. I think just the opposite. Death and life, it's the fear of death and the unwillingness to face death that creates life as a non-life, that makes life a culture of objects and power and positions and all those other things, including social, etc.
Well, and part of it is, I would say, is because that's the way that he begins the novella, that's what he is saying is the subject the subject sentence going forward. And I think then how do his wife and his daughter treat him at the end? He has created that culture that they now treat him with. How do the doctors treat him at the end? He has created that culture that the doctors now treat him with. There's a sense in which he created the culture that he now must move through, and he is amazed by people's lack of care that he exhibited during his lifetime.
Let me reintroduce our guests. We're about halfway through the Keeping the Faith program this afternoon on WILL, a radio service of the College of Media at Illinois. AM 580 presents Keeping the Faith every Sunday from 5 to 6 p.m. Central Time. Our guest today, talking about the Tolstoy short novel, The Death of Ivan Illich. We have with us Rabbi Norman Klein from Sinai Temple. We have Sensei Elihu Genmyo Smith from the Prairie Zen Center. We have Reverend Tracy Heilman and Reverend Mike Mulberry from the Community United Church of Christ. And I'm Steve Shoemaker, a completely neutral Protestant Christian. But in spite of our outnumbering our guests in terms of Christianity here, we do encourage listeners to call. If you have a comment or question, do give us a buzz, 1-800-222-9455 if it's a long-distance call, and that includes people who are listening on the Internet at will.illinois.edu, 1-800-222-9455 is a toll-free call. If you're in Champaign-Urbana, punch in 333-9455. Coming up next week on Keeping the Faith, our guest will be Professor David Wilson, talking about inequality and gentrification. On May 11th, after having survived the Orthodox Easter, Father James Ellison will be our guest from the Antiochian Orthodox Church. Later in May, Wayne Wagers will be our guest on the 25th of May. Well, let's get back to our discussion. This is part of the Big Read Project, the last event in this wonderful series of book discussions and lectures and radio shows and films, all kinds of things, around this project by the National Endowment for the Humanities, where all across this country people are reading Leo Tolstoy and The Death of Ivan Illich. So let's continue our talk. Let's talk about the end of the book, because that's where so much happens. It's very soon before his death, in the last few paragraphs of the book, that Tolstoy describes this, what is it, a change, a realization, mm-hmm. A moment of truth, where this character Ivan Illich sees most of his life as somehow having been a lie, and only at this moment sees what's true, what's valuable. What do you think about that?
I have a strong reaction to it, because deathbed conversions are not customary in my faith. And
Judaism does not encourage this.
That's right. And it's much more important how you live your life, sure, than what you're thinking when you die,
yeah,
because intention is less important than action in our in Judaism, even though intention is important. It's what you do ultimately that has value. So if he's lived a life that is completely fallacious, and while he's dying, he has all these wonderful thoughts that culminate in a kind of transformation that is completely unexpressed in the outside world. I mean, they're seeing him, as Elihu mentioned, at the very end, you know, going through the last stages of dying, which...
Very painful.
Very painful, very upsetting to those on the outside. And internally, he's feeling, you know, above it all. It still does nothing to society, to change society, to change the feelings of his family, and so on and so forth. So I had to look elsewhere for, you might say, the satisfaction, so to speak, in the story, the happy ending, in a way. And for me, the most, how to put it, warm and positive thing I could come up with was the brief moments, and also at the very end, where he seems to be able to get outside of himself and identify with other people, empathize with their feelings, you know, imagining how difficult it is for his wife and for his son and for his daughter even, right, to watch him die. And not thinking it's all about me, and at least briefly thinking it's all about us, in a way.
He does at least try to express that. But
yeah.
So not much action, but a little.
I found that satisfying. You know, he takes his hand and he puts it on his son's head, I think, and his son kisses it, and there's a kind of relationship expressed there that that was positive and loving. And to me, to bring in another literary source, another novel I love very much, Les Miserables by Victor Hugo, and those who may not have read the novel may have seen the musical, which is also very good, amazingly enough, and repeated in both the novel and the musical is this statement that to see the face of God in every person you meet is sort of the ideal way of relating, because then you express your admiration for all those good things in life by seeing that expressed in your fellow human being.
But those same human beings that may occasionally be godly can also just treat you like crap.
Right.
But that's still godlike.
That's right. Yeah, I agree with Elihu there.
See, you can't think of godlike as positive characteristics. Godlike, it doesn't matter how they treat you. You have to see the God even if they're treating you badly, even if they're being evil. Otherwise, it's not God.
So you don't believe that there's some evil force.
Right.
Well, no, yeah.
I'd like to ask
Norman something, because if I could just switch hats for a moment and ask, as far as I understand Judaism, there is deathbed confession.
Yes,
and there
absolutely.
Is vidui, deathbed.
Yeah.
Yes, there is vidui. And vidui is most significant. And if you do vidui and if you do tshuva at the deathbed, and you, I won't say too much more about it, but that is considered most significant. And that, in a way, takes care of all the past in a certain sense. So I don't agree that Judaism would say the social relations and all that. Of course, you have the consequences of what you did, but still, deathbed. I won't call it conversion.
But it sounds suspiciously like sort of evangelical Christian notions of deathbed conversions, where you can have lived a horrible life and treated everybody rotten and been violent and greedy and selfish, and then, oh, if I say the right words or have the right feelings on my deathbed, everything is fine.
No, but see,
and I think there's so many passages, at least in the New Testament, I don't know the Hebrew Scriptures as well, but in the New Testament where not only individuals, but whole nations are judged not by their feelings, but by how they treated the poor, how they treated other people, whether they lived lives of peace. So it doesn't ring true
to me. I could say two things to that. First is, if you do as you just said, you say, well, I'm going to do this, and then I'll confess or I'll repent, that doesn't count, because that kind of repentance is already inherently not okay. Because it's based on saying I'm going to do bad and then repent doesn't count. In fact, that's specifically addressed in the Hebrew Scriptures. But let's go a step further. The fact that you repent doesn't mean you still don't have the consequences. And I'll just shift into Buddhist view now. You still have the karmic consequences of what you did. It just means that you now also have this shift, which is what he has. He, in this, Tolstoy says, he says, and it was revealed to him that his life had not been what it should have been, but that he could still rectify the situation. But what is the real thing, he asked himself, and grew quiet, listening. In a sense, he was being present. And that's when it goes, and then suddenly, if I could skip ahead, it became clear to him that what had been oppressing him and would not leave him, which is this fear of death, this suffering that came as a result of that, suddenly was vanishing all at once. And then what comes out is the compassion for the others. He felt sorry for them, and he had to do something to deliver them and himself from suffering. This is very much, you know, in a sense, you could say very a Buddhist a perspective, which is, as I said, what I understand Tolstoy was attempting to integrate. Whether he was doing it or not, I see it there very clearly.
Just to get back briefly to this confessional thing at the end, I certainly, you know, help people in regard to the issue of, you know, saying vidui when they're in their states of dying at the end of life. But I see it mostly as a way of comforting a person as they're dying. I don't see it as in any way an absolving in any way of their misdeeds. The fact that they have a realization of what they've done is good. That's right. The problematic aspect of that from the Jewish point of view is even if they fully come to an understanding of what they had done and how they really should have behaved and corrected it, they have no longer an opportunity to do that. And that's the, at least as I see it, though there are different Jewish views on the subject, even in regard to the afterlife, as I see it, they had their chance and they basically blew it. Mm. There's another Jewish reference that might be germane here, because we're finishing Passover. This is the last day. It's the eighth day. And in the Seder, we have this song called Chag Gadya. And it's all about us, allegorically, the series of empires that conquered Israel and then successively conquered each other. And then at the very end, it says the angel of death comes and kills the last great empire, and then God comes and kills the angel of death.
Mm-hmm.
And I've always wondered about that, you know, exactly what's going on there, because does that mean, as Elihu was suggesting, that it may be a commonality with Buddhism, the fear of death is mm-hmm. eliminated, so there's a sense of oneness about the whole progress from life to death, before life to afterlife? Mm-hmm. Or does it mean that that's the end of death, you know, and kind of the, you might say, what has come to be often seen as a Christian scenario where the Messiah comes and the whole thing is resolved one way or the other, which derives in many ways from Judaism. So even that song is a bit of a conundrum. I'd love to hear people's reaction to that. But it ties in with the very end of the novel, to bring it back to that, when he says, and the line right before the end, Tolstoy does, or actually Ivan Ilyich says, "Death is over," he said to himself. "There is no more death."
Mm-hmm.
So, to me, that's a very problematic sentence, because I'm not sure whether it just means I don't fear death anymore, therefore it has no power over me, or in some way I have become a victor over death.
That's a Christian theological statement.
Yeah. I figured that probably was the case,
yeah.
And yet he was, as I said in the introduction, he was kicked out of the Russian Orthodox Church for,
eventually,
I guess, heretical beliefs. So
right.
I'm not exactly sure if this is
late
deviation.
Late in his life.
It's all good Christians.
It's a very Buddhist term. I mean, Buddhism says, first, birth doesn't turn into death. Birth is a thing in itself. Death is a thing in itself. But you go a step further. Birth is unborn, undying. Death is unborn, undying. In Buddhism, we talk about the deathless. Life is deathless. Life is unborn. Death is deathless. Death is unborn. So, see, but to really clarify this in our own living and functioning is really what religious practice is, so that it becomes something that's actual and true for us, and then we can live out of this wisdom in our compassion.
I had a difficult time reading this, partly because just 2 months ago, I was in intensive care myself, and my family was worried that I might not come out of it because of a septic shock experience. And I'm pleased that I'm much better.
Yeah.
But it was interesting reading this book as I was recovering from a life-threatening illness.
Mm-hmm.
And I think life is definitely better.
Do you mean life is better than
if
death,
you
or
so.
Your life now is better than your life before?
Life is better than death, yeah.
Okay.
I'd like to speak strongly in favor of life.
I'm you into know, that.
One of the things that I'm just kind of noticing now, and I think, Rabbi, you brought this up, that as Ivan was looking back on his life, trying to find some moment of meaning, love, goodness, it was when his mother's hand was on his head, when she was offering love to him. And when he first talks about seeing light at the end, it's when he's kind of flailing about and his hand lands on his son's head.
Mm-hmm.
That's when he says it's at that moment that it was revealed to him that his life wasn't what it should have been. And now maybe I'm reading this too much as a parent, too much as a teacher, But I know I sometimes live my life looking at what the children I interact with, what am I offering to them? What am I showing them about how to live? And so I kind of see that end, that death is not the final answer for him. It's when he finally connects with one of his children and has a real moment of truly loving them and truly seeing that child for who that child is. And he sees his son respond to him in a way that's different than the way he responded at that age, that his son looks back and is crying. So his son has somehow, in the midst of the life that they all lived and in the midst of the scripts, his son learned to care and to love. And that's the victory.
Well, and forget, let it pass. I mean, that can be both.
Either way.
He's saying to them, my life, forget, let it pass.
I find it interesting what he does with this peasant boy character, Gerasim, if that's close to the right pronunciation. Does he idealize the poor, uneducated peasant who, although it's written from the view that the author knows everything, omniscient, you know, we don't see the motives of this young boy. We do see him caring, seeming to care for him. He clearly does things to make his pain less. He holds up his feet. He carries out his slop. He's making his life better. We don't really know why. Is he motivated purely out of goodness and compassion? We're never really told. We just see these acts to which Ivan Illich responds with these moments of self-realization that he hasn't done that much in his life.
You know,
he hasn't related to other people in that way.
I was just in the course of reading a book about Russian culture, and one of the things that I read about that actually, I guess, started in, maybe in France for all I know, you know, this sort of idealization of the peasant. Mm-hmm. You have...
love for the mud, yes.
That's right. You know, when right before the Russian the French Revolution and the destruction of the royal house in France, one of the things that made the queen so abhorred was she had this palace, the Tuileries, that was sort of an idealized country setting that she spent extravagant amounts of money on to play being a peasant. Mm. And I think there's something of that in Tolstoy's, who after all was a Count Tolstoy, mm-hmm. his idealization of the peasant. I don't fault him on it. He was looking for truth, and he thought he found it there. It's kind of almost like in other cultures, such as maybe in America, where we've gone from we fluctuate between the American Indian being the enemy to the American Indian being the ideal, the one who, I remember these advertisements showing an Indian being sad because the rivers are being polluted and we should be more ecologically conscious. And it's as if we project all of our hopes onto another that is essentially alien from us on some level, and we're projecting without any understanding of the reality of the situation. So I think Gerasim, in a way, is a bit that way, because in the introduction they mentioned that Tolstoy actually had this extraordinary fear of death and at one point went to a remote setting in the hopes of, with a peasant, one of his peasant young serfs to accompany him, and was expecting this young serf to somehow console him, and he didn't. But in the story, he can make that happen.
Mm-hmm. Well, in one sense, I mean, it is true that Tolstoy idealized the serf or peasants and at the same time had a different relationship than other nobility in the sense of freeing some of them and giving them a lot more. But the other sense is that he does limit what he talks about them or this boy, Gerasim, in a very ordinary activities functioning rather than all the mental speculation and additional motives that he gives to all the other characters. So in a sense, he is saying something about how he sees that person operating. Whether there are additional motives or not, we don't know. But this is Tolstoy's expression of what he thinks, how he thinks such a person operates, doing ordinary, simple, everyday activities, and the value that he places on it.
We're running out of time very quickly. From each of you, a reason perhaps for our listener who's not read this book to read it.
You know, I would say what came to me the whole time I was reading it was it can be a wake-up call for us also. Again, Rabbi, you said something at one point about Ivan's life, you know, that he was successful. And yet if you look back, it's like, well, what exactly? He didn't like his job. He didn't like his family. He didn't have joy in everything, in anything. And yet I think for many of us today, we have that same sense of what is our success. So I think it can be a wake-up call for us also.
We're going to need to let that be the final comment for the panel. That was a good summation. I want to thank Tracy Howman, Mike Mulberry, Norman Klein, and Elihu Smith for being our panelists today as we've finished up the Big Read Project here in Champaign-Urbana. Let me remind people that Keeping the Faith is sponsored in part by the University YMCA, where I'm the executive director. One of our big projects comes up this spring, starting May 5th, where we collect things for our big dump and run project. We collect furniture, especially furniture, household goods, electronics that work, not computer monitors, please, or old TVs, but things that students will find helpful in the fall when they come here, particularly international students. We collect them in the spring. Starting May 5th, we can bring them to the University YMCA at 1001 South Wright Street in Champaign. If you have any questions, give us a call, 337-1500. You can ask for me, Steve Shoemaker, or Casey Umland, our program director. We'll be collecting things throughout the month of May. We'll also be collecting them in August before our big sales starting at the Stock Pavilion the first week of University of Illinois classes. So I encourage people to clean out their closets and garages and attics and bring things to the Y. Coming up on Keeping the Faith next week, our guest will be Professor David Wilson talking about inequality and gentrification. The following week, Father James Ellison from the Antiochian Orthodox Church. I'm Steve Shoemaker. Thanks for listening to Keeping the Faith.
You've been listening to Keepin' the Faith, the production of WILL AM 580. The opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants.